Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, one more Saturday. Welcome to Politics Done Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Thank you for giving me some of your time this weekend. This was a pretty active week, wasn't it? I mean, we had the election of a new pope. A lot of time spent on watching that. We had a senator, a very conservative senator, who in the past was very, very much in gay marriage, come out in favor of gay marriage. We had a state Republican congressman. Well, let me take that one last. We had a pretty good email letter sent out by Michael Moore with what he thought could begin the demise of the NRA as we know it. So this was a pretty busy week. I mean, while writing up the show today and putting all the things together and putting all the blog posts that I did this week, my God, I didn't realize so much happened when I put it out there. I didn't even get a chance to put them all on the blog post because I just thought it was, you know, there were just too many. So I chose, I think, the 14 best of the ones that I, well, the 14 ones that I think are sort of relevant to the show that we want to give today. But folks, please give us a call, 646-929-2495. If you want to talk to me or talk to the audience, push 1 so that we can see that you want to talk and you'll get on air. We're easy going here. We want to get a conversation going. And so don't be scared to get on and mix it up a bit. We like to hear every side of every discussion here. We don't discriminate whether you're libertarian, liberal, conservative, right-wing, Tea Party. I really don't care what you are, because ultimately we are what? We're all Americans. And what the one thing that we have to learn to do as Americans is to be able to have diverse opinions, completely diverse opinions, and still look at that person and say, you know, man, that's your opinion, still like you, but that's just your opinion. Well, I'm going to start with the darkest part of the week. It had to do with a state congressman from South Carolina. He put out a statement. And I'm going to read the blog that I wrote for that one. But beforehand, I want to give some kudos to the Coffee Party family, to the Coffee Party brothers and sisters, to the Coffee Party domain, if you will. Usually when I put a blog out there that I think is going to be a bit controversial, I kind of hang around the thread just in case something gets out of hand. And this one, given that it had sort of a racial connotation from this guy in South Carolina and the president, and I know that we have a lot of diverse opinions on Coffee Party, I figured I better hang around that thread. I thought I was going to have to do a hell of a lot more work on that thread than I did, because I think the performance of the group in general, both those that completely disagreed with me and those that agreed with me, it was pretty darn civil. You had some people, of course, hey, they call me a socialist and a racist. Every now and then you get that little slippage in there. But that's okay. It doesn't quite matter. But like I said, it was great. Oh, wow, I didn't know that, Bob. You said that I had a bad link to the show. Ouch. Didn't realize that. I thought I tested the link before I sent it out by email. Anyhow, folks just need to get to, if you want to, if you're listening now, you evidently found the link appropriately or found the link correctly. Anywho, let me go ahead and start by reading that blog. And folks, remember, I'd like you to call in. The number is 646-929-2495. Don't be scared to talk. We're a friendly bunch here. Just push one so that I can know that you want to talk. But here goes the blog that I wrote that was supposed to be controversial at the coffee party site that turned out not to be as controversial as I expected it to be. Here goes it. Republicans usually claim that policy differences and the president's refusal to compromise is the reason why they buck President Obama at every turn. Liberals, in turn, are generally frustrated because the president has always been willing to compromise away that which liberals hold dearly. Lest one forget, liberals wanted a much larger stimulus, with most of it going to spending as opposed to tax cuts. The president compromised on that. Liberals wanted a single-payer health care system, which the president once supported, at best, but a public option at minimum. The president compromised that away. Liberals wanted the Bush tax cuts to expire on all those making above $250,000. The president compromised that number up to $400,000. There was a time when a healthcare mandate was the major aspect of a Republican healthcare proposal. Like, I don't know if you guys remember, but during the Nixon times, every time it came up, they staunchly believed in a personal mandate, a healthcare mandate, because they wanted to say personal responsibility would dictate that everybody had a skin in the game. It was a personal responsibility clause Republicans came they wanted. Yet, when President Obama supported it, they vilified him for doing it, and they attempted to use it to overturn Obamacare in the Supreme Court. Before the paint was dry in the White House, Republicans met at a hotel to make plans to paralyze President Obama. Senator McConnell specifically stated his goal was to make the president a one-term president. President Clinton and many other presidents have suffered attacks from other parties. In my lifetime, I have yet to see the types of attacks and disrespect this president, President Obama, has had to endure. He is, in fact, the Jackie Robinson of the presidency. There are many anecdotal incidences, and in the blog I show the different incidences here to prove this. Now, there is even more political evidence directly from the Republican caucus. Huffington Post reported the following, and I read the excerpt from the Huffington Post. It says, Democrats jump on South Carolina State Representative Chris Crawford this week after his vote against Medicaid expansion, helping to bring attention to racially charged comments he made on the issue in January. In a January interview with the Charleston Regional Business Journal, Crawford explained that he, unlike many of his Republican colleagues, supported the measure to expand Medicaid eligibility under President Barack Obama's health care law. But Crawford predicted that he would be a dissenting voice in his party, suggesting that his fellow Republicans knew they would benefit from opposing Obama, in part because of race. The politics are going to, this is Crawford speaking, the politics are going to overwhelm the policy, Crawford said. It is good politics to oppose the black guy in the White House right now, especially for the Republican Party. The comment didn't get much pickup until Tuesday, when it came time for the State House to vote on the Medicaid expansion bill. Guess what? Crawford, a one-time proponent of the effort, voted with his party to reject it. While Republicans continue to play racial, this is me now, while Republicans continue to play racial politics, the country suffers. It is evident that the party that loves talking family values, human values, and religious values failed every value they expounded. Now, I don't think that was a very controversial blog, but I just knew once you put that little word, that tiny little word race in there, it would have likely gotten a bit of a tone. Well, it didn't. Actually, it went pretty good. A lot of people complained. Most people were appalled at the congressman. Likewise, after a few hours, I noticed Eric posted a pretty nice vlog, and he also kind of linked it to the immigration issue. It's worth a read. After Eric posted the blog, I went ahead and cross-blogged what he did and sort of describe a bit more of what happened. It's a good read, a good thing to follow. So, what do you think? 646-929-2495. Before I go to the next subject, I'd like to hear live if anybody has any comments. See many of you here online, but nobody, and on the phone, but nobody's pushing one to talk. Is anybody going to come and tell me, Egberto, I think this, or Coffee Party Family, I think that? 646-929-2495. Okay, I see one person is ready to speak. 518, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Egberto, Joe Pomponio in Albany, New York.
Hey, Mr. Pomponio, how you doing, my brother?
Pretty good. Okay, I caught the show from the beginning.
Great.
I can only agree with you. That might be why you're not getting too many ones. look, this has been a racial thing since he got elected. Mm-hmm. Okay, he's invited them. The news media talks about, he's turning on a charm offensive. He's doing this, he's doing that. These people have been invited many, many a time through his first term. The second term election reaffirmed that people wanted him. So now they're at least willing, if you notice, to see him in private, okay? The dinner, there are no pictures. They don't
right.
want pictures of him being seen with them. You look at what they did with Chris Christie, okay? He's been chastised. For what? For two people getting together to look out for the citizens of a district in a catastrophe. It's a joke. It's a total joke. I'd like to bring up something I did see on the news yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, it was online this morning about this CPAC convention.
Right.
There's a person there. They have these meetings. I'm not too familiar with how they operate. But I caught a piece online where one of the, not a participant, a guest, a person in the audience, if you will, was remarking to an African-American, saying how the Conservative Party helps other African-American communities. And the man made an absurd statement relating to the fact that the Conservative Party should recognize that slave owners were basically saviors to the slaves at that time for providing them with food and shelter. This is the type of thing that goes on with, I'm not going to say all of them, but there are good conservatives out there. But now, when you have people like this in your party, okay, and they can openly do this at one of your meetings, it gives question to your validity of what you want to do to embrace other nationalities and other people to hear your side of the economic scale. And this thing with Obama is, it's an absurdity. I grew up in a real weird environment. I grew up around all kinds of people. All races, all colors, all religions. Okay, I observed the Asian New Year with the Vietnamese. I'm making corned beef and cabbage tomorrow. I do St. Patrick's Day. I go with the 4th of July. I hate to use an old term, but we're a melting pot. This
Amen.
Is who we are. This is what the Statue of Liberty says. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. That's why we're here. We're not here to pick on each other. We're not here to degrade someone else because of what they believe or how they believe or what color they are. Now, maybe I'm weird, okay, because I have a lot of people that tell me that. But, yeah, I mean, where do you go with this? How do you promote something like that? How do you open people's eyes? You know, I mean, I don't get it. I get my side. And, you know, you try to be fair, but it goes on and on.
I don't think you're weird at all. I mean, I tell you better, Joe. I think most of it comes from fear. And one of the things that I try to do by not hitting people hard when they get, let's say, racial on me. It's not very hard to get racial on me in a lot of the domains that I actually go into. But what I try to do is create that sense of comfort then so that folks can start that opening up process. Because a lot of times when you see people act racial, it's fear. Now, what gets me upset with the politicians, however, is that they are not fearful. They're not like some of their constituencies who have lived isolated lives, who have lived in a rural area, and their exposure to other cultures is the negative stereotypes they see on television. So, of course, they form a certain... I remember when I went to China, there were some interesting... When you sit down and have conversations with people, you realize that what America promotes overseas with some of its movies, it allows people to make false stereotypes on a lot of people that, you know, that they see on these movies. So there's a lot of explaining off to do when you go overseas and so forth. Now, right here in America, it's the same thing. You have people that are isolated in these areas, and they live within their little frameworks, and they can't get out of it. What they need is they need to get that comfort level from people that they already respect. That is why I get so upset at politicians, because instead of being educators in chief, they could have made such a big difference by embracing this president for the country. And if they had just shown that to the country at large, we would start being able to talk policy and this would be moved off the table completely. But they are not willing to do that because they figure divide and conquer is that much easier to get your specific goal than to try to say, let's do what's best for America, and then may the best opinions win. No, let's throw race in there, and people stop talking about what's important, and then they talk about things like race. So, I mean, all of this is well calculated. They don't want the healthcare plan, so they use race to sort of categorize people against it. So you're so right. And now, as far as how you grew up, Joe, it was great hearing that. I love the way I grew up, the way I am now, the where I live, all of that gives that advantage that you can go and adapt. You can go and infuse yourself in just about every culture. And you know what? If you actually infuse yourself in these cultures, other cultures that's not necessarily your own, it is so much darn fun. You get to try so many different things. I mean, it's so much so beats the monotony, don't you think?
Totally agree. I spent 8 years in Washington Heights. I don't know if you know where that is in Manhattan, but I lived in a Latino Hispanic community. And I'd like to just touch on that lightly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hispanics
and 6-3-0, I want to go to you next.
Hispanics and Latinos are the same and different. Mm-hmm. Hispanics generally refer to the continental part of South America and Central America.
Right.
Latinos are island people, and though they're the same, they have cultural differences. Now, I'm explaining the difference. I'm not trying to denigrate either side, but Latino people are a lot more open. They come from an environment, if I could use the term, dance and be happy. The Hispanics, on the other hand, are a lot more earthy, okay? They're a lot more tied to the land. The economy has a great bearing in their way of life, in how they have to live and share. So, you know, you'd have to live there to understand it. And there are differences between them, quite similar to different race relations within our own country. They just don't take it to the kind of extreme we do here. Now, to touch on what you said about the politicians, you are right. They definitely use the race card, if I could use that terminology, to go after the policies they don't want. And those policies, as I track them back and I look at them, are to benefit the few, the ones with the power. And that's who they're playing to, if you will. That's who supports their campaigns. That's who wants the CPACs, okay, and Citizens United money, okay, to be used to promote their own interests through these people. That's whose voice they're speaking. They're not speaking for their constituents, right? And the constituents that do follow them because they directly or indirectly are influenced through people like Freedom Works and these other groups that play to them, that will have meetings. And you want to talk about the takers, right? Well, they're the givers in this sense. They're the ones that'll provide the bus service, give them the hotel rooms. This is not grassroots, all right? This is a political plan. And I better leave it there. I can get carried away on this.
Well, let me tell you, you're so right, Joe. I am going to, in fact, the next subject that we're going to tackle is Obama going down the debt debate. I'm going to read that blog after we're done with this subject here. But thank you. That was, you hit it spot on. Now, 630, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, Gordo, it's Jeff McKinley.
Hey, Jeff. I'm going to tell you something, Jeff. After I wrote that blog on the Coffee Party site, I saw that you had a response, right? And
yep.
I said, you know what? I know my brother's going to give me a call today. And 936, you're after Jeff, man. So go at it, Jeff. Let me have it.
Well, I really...
Hold on. Folks, just to let you guys know that this show is open to everybody. Jeff is one of my longtime listeners, love very much, and he thinks diametrically opposed to me. And we do get along, don't we, Jeff?
Yeah, we sure do.
All right, go ahead, my brother.
You know, I wasn't going to, you know, comment on this, but I think it, you know, it deserves, you know, further explanation. You know,
sure.
I believe that this whole idea of racism is a red herring, and anything that detracts, you know, focus from the real issues out there is counterproductive of moving, you know, the country and, you know, the discussion forward. And I think this whole thing is of racism is, you know, and you've had journalists getting together and they said, okay, well, if you can't argue on, and this is from the left, if you can't argue on, you know, the facts, you know, and there was a whole, you know, email correspondence about this on some blog that became public, and they said, well, use the race card, call them a racist. And I think that there's too much of that out there. You know, this country has developed very far, but we are a country of 300-plus million people. You're going to find the cretins and small-minded people out there that want to ascribe and stereotype people and be racist. You know, that. But to me, I guess I find that so reprehensible because, you know, I'll quote Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand says that the greatest, you know, the smallest minority is the individual. You know, to ascribe any kind of an evaluation or characteristic to a person based on their appearance or what group they belong to is really kind of a collective group thing. And when you're not seeing people as individuals, I find that reprehensible. And I, you know, to me, and maybe it's just my perspective, the whole argument isn't, you know, Barack Obama is, you know, half white and half black. I don't know, you know, which one do we pick there? To me, I don't care. But what this does is this detracts And it's kind of a lure that, you know, makes us lose our focus on the real substance of the argument and what the real substance of the argument is, what is the proper role of government. And, you know, to toss these racism things in there, right now we're wasting time not talking about the proper role of government, the dangers of centralization of power, and what's effective, what's not effective, because we're talking about racism. Now, that is unproductive because it wastes time. Are there some racists out there? Yeah, there are.
Jeff,
but,
can I ask you one thing? Because, first of all, I agree with everything that you've said so far, but I want to get a little bit defensive here. For what I did, for why I put the race thing out there on the big platform. And the reason was, if your argument is legitimate, okay, what's the proper role of government? You and I disagree on that, but we should be having that discussion.
Right.
But because we're talking about race, that discussion is on hold. And what I'm trying to tell you here with the reason I put that out there is, if I don't bring that subject that congressman says within the confines of the GOP's caucus where they discuss this, they have the, and by the way, 936, after Jeff, I'm coming to you, when they discuss that, when he can come out and say that, we need to know that the objection isn't because of policy, but because of something other, and that other is a silly thing as race. Because what happens is, average American, non-racist America, most America, okay, they sit back and they see this big debate between the president and let's say the Republican Congress or whatever, and they think that there is a real policy debate going on when it isn't. There are other reasons that's being used to vote against these particular policies. The mere fact that they go against a lot of policies that they want supported because this president supported. Whether you like it or not, you know, that's what they're doing. So my question to you then, Jeff, is what should we do? How do we dispel it? Don't we have to first take the scab off so that the wound can heal appropriately? Or do we just go ahead and say ignore that little thing and try to just move on?
Well, I guess it's all a matter of magnitude. And, you know, here's probably a bad example, but, you know, Hank Johnson was questioning an admiral in the Navy if there was a big issue, if we had too many, you know, troops on Guam, if the island would tip over, okay?
I heard that one. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, and so should we be, you know, Hank Johnson said that. Should we be discussing that fact? Well, it's like, no, because the island isn't going to capsize. So, but my point here, I may not be explaining it well, is, I think that this racism is a red herring. I don't believe, you know, if people at FreedomWorks, you know, in a lot of these other places, they're not racist. It isn't an issue of racism. And I think that to focus on that, you know, if you went to the KKK and started talking about this stuff, it's going to look like racism is everything. But they're not representative. And I believe, sure, there's racism. There's racism in all parties. But I believe that this is such a minor part of it, and I think that it glosses over and dismisses the ideological stand that some people are making. If, you know, if this guy said it, and there's some racists out there, but it really shouldn't be given this time, because I don't think that the magnitude is that great, and I don't think that it's driving policy decisions and votes.
Okay, I'm going to tell you the part of what you said that I disagree with. I agree with you that most of the people at FreedomWorks are not racist. Most of the politicians out there in Washington are not racist. In fact, if you notice when the cameras are – did you see when President Obama went up to shake my senator's, Cornyn's, hands, when he went to shake McConnell's hands, when he went to shake – what's the lady senator's hands? I don't remember her name. But if you notice, these guys were almost happy and in awe to shake the president's hands. But immediately thereafter, they were on the floor talking, he doesn't want to come to the table or spend or whatever. There are two realities here, and – I think you acknowledge that there are two realities here. One is the show, and one is policy. The problem is that they are using they're using racism of the few, or the fear, not the racism of those, their constituency, to actually advance their goal. In other words, they're not trying to advance their goals on the merits of a policy. but they're using the fear of racism to do exactly what you said they're doing, smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, I don't know if I would agree with that, because I don't know that the magnitude of racism exists out there for them to be able to play to it, you know, to their advantage. That presupposes that there are a lot of racists out there.
I think you have to go to what Joe Pomponio was stating earlier at the CPAC convention. But Jeff, stay with me. This is a good conversation, and I want to get off of the race thing pretty quickly after I answer the thing, and then go on to the to Obama, the debt, and so forth. And I know you're going to have a lot to say about the debt if you're able to stick around. But let me go to 936, and then I'll come back to you, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. 936, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hi, this is Bruce Barnes in the Woodlands.
Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
Okay, how are you today?
Talk to me, Bruce.
Okay, I saw a YouTube clip of a Tea Party lady in North Carolina, and she was talking about most of the Tea Party things, but she talked about history. And in her view, Democrats were in the past very racist, and then it's Republicans. What she doesn't realize that Lincoln was a Republican.
Absolutely.
And when Lincoln was a Republican, he was a liberal Republican, and he thought of equality and that all the races and everybody should be free. And that turned the South, who was the Confederate States, over to Democrats. Okay, and for years they had the Democratic racist Jim Crow laws and things in the South, and they were very conservative. And then we had Johnson in the 60s. And when Johnson came out with civil rights and said that the black people ought to be able to vote and have all the rights of everyone else, it turned the South into Republicans. And those Republicans were also very conservative. So it united the entire nation of we have conservative Republicans. And on the other side, we had Democrats who were liberal, and now they're a smaller majority. So we have and in the 60s and 70s, racism and civil rights were changed so that people did not want to acknowledge they were racist, because black people also had to vote and other things. So they had to go to something else. So Reagan came out with poor people. So then we had a war against poor people, and the politically correct, you don't say it's racism. You don't say that you're against one thing or another, but it's still the undercurrent there. And when they're talking about the poor, they're meaning black people, even mm-hmm. though the majority is white people. Okay? So now we have a undercurrent of the racism that can't say that they're racism, but they're against poor people. And so we then had Reagan, who came out and said, we've got all these
welfare queens
and other people who are poor, but we want to discriminate against them. They are the takers, not the makers. And we've had that for years with the undercurrent that nobody wants to say they're racist. Okay? There still is a lot of racism in this country, and it's a undercurrent. So now we get to class war, okay, where we have the 1% that is controlling the country. They're controlling our politicians. They're buying them off with all their money. You don't see poor people buying politicians. They don't have money. Okay, so now we have the middle class going down and the 1% getting all the breaks from the government.
Now, Bruce, let me say one. Let me interject here a bit, Bruce, because your history is very well about how the Dixiecrats became the new Republicans, et cetera, and how things kind of flipped. Now, I just want to add something to that, and that is, once you brought up class warfare, and by the way, folks, I wrote a book called As I See It, Class Warfare, The Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom, and it covers a whole lot of what was actually said. The interesting thing that I think you alluded to is the 1% folk that are really the ones that I call the takers, and I know Jeff is going to have something to say about this later, but the people I consider the takers, they depend on continuing the process, this racism, they depend on that. Because if they can keep the lower class, let's say lower classes of whites and the lower classes of all these other groups at each other's throat, thinking that someone is taking a bit of the crumbs from the other, nobody's really watching the house. And in a lot of ways, that is exactly what occurs. And what I think is happening in America, and a coffee party with the information that we put out there as well, I think is aiding, is you actually educate Americans to what is really going on, and when they're educated to what is really going on, they suddenly start to vote differently. Remember that technically speaking, under this economic condition, a Barack Obama or somebody like him should not have won the election. People went against what their carnal being at times to say, wait, something is wrong with the other policies that's being promoted. This is what I think is the best of all positions. Bruce, my lines are heating up. Stay with me, please. I have to take a few more calls, but I'm going to bring you back in. Okay?
You said it very well, and I'll get off. I'll come back if I need to.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, let me go to 954. 954, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, it's Neil. How you doing?
Hey, Neil. Talk to me, my brother.
Well, you know, the thing is, I blame the media. The media doesn't go after, you know, the Republicans. I mean, they keep on talking about the deficit. They weren't concerned about the deficit because it didn't matter during the Bush administration.
Neil, let me, if you're going to talk about the deficit, I beg you to stay on, because the next blog I'm going to read is going to really hit Obama on falling into that trap. And I really want to hear what you have to say about that. Are you going to just talk deficit or the race thing?
We can talk about the race thing, too. I mean, the race
okay.
thing is, you know, with the CPAC, you heard what happened yesterday at
yes,
CPAC.
That's what Joe, I think, was talking about before, but just give the people that just are just joining the call like a 30-second synopsis.
Well, basically, I don't know the guy, what his name was, but he was talking about, they interviewed him, about racism wasn't that bad and that slavery was good. They got free, you know, food and they got free wage and that, and he was saying about, you know, and in the good old days when women didn't interrupt men when they were speaking. He was basically just, it was like listening to someone from the Klan. I mean, this person had connections to neo-Nazism and the Klan, and he was very well respected in CPAC. And they interviewed him, and it was all over the blogs. It was all over Facebook. Racism, you know, fear is really what the GOP has, and that's their trump card over and over again, to cause fear of anyone that looks differently, anyone, race, gender, anything.
You know, Neil, actually, that is exactly right. But again, when you are a real, real minority party, that is the only way you can keep power. Those are the kinds of things that you have to do to keep power. But, Neil, I'm going to come back with you because after this, I'm going to read my blog on the debt, and then I'm going to come back. I want to hear both your point of view and Jeff and others. Okay, so let me get
okay.
to 414, and I'll be back with you.
Sure.
414, who do I have the honor of speaking with? 414, you're on.
Oh, sorry. That would be me, I guess, eh?
Yeah, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Bob Whitney from Cudahy. Sorry.
Bob, thank you for calling. How can I add to the discussion?
Well, I was just going to write something on the blog here, but or on the chat. I think this whole race thing is a serious distraction from the primary issue, which is an economic thing. I don't think it's so much class warfare or warfare against blacks or any other minority. I think it's an economic class warfare. I don't like the idea of class warfare just because, you know, you think that classical music is good, that that puts you in a different class from people who think it's horrible and prefer country western.
I hear you.
That doesn't make sense. But that's class warfare. But when we're talking economic warfare, hey, class economic warfare is legitimate. I mean, hell, just about any other revolution was regarding this sort of economic class distinctions. I mean, you look at the situation, and I think most people can agree that the black community is disproportionately, let's call them, poor, and as are the Hispanic communities relative to the white. But in terms of absolute numbers, the actual numbers of poor people, a majority of them are white.
But most people don't know the reality. That, Bob, that's a reality that most Americans really do not know, because that's
exactly
not what portrayed on network TV or otherwise. It's our job here, yourself and others, with your sphere of reference, to let people know they really have all skin in the games. Every group has every group have all the classes in them, and not only that, while the minority groups are, because of history, disproportionately or worse off. And I think I have to say it now that you mentioned that. When people hear about minorities being inherently poorer than the majority, I hope they don't think that is something that's intrinsic to the body. What it is, it's because of past wrongs. Their springboard started later. So it's important that people get that. I'm not trying to take personal responsibility or anything away from anybody, but do remember that the way you grew up and the affects that you had in life make a difference to your future. Bob, is there something you want to add before I go to 661?
Well, basically, to put it in the gross form, but poor white trash is there's a lot more of them than poor black folks, in my opinion. And I think that the poor white folks need to they need to be able to realize that they have a lot in common with other poor folks, regardless
exactly
of race.
And I'll definitely not say poor white trash. It's just poor whites, poor blacks. Otherwise, because the reality about it is, there's nothing trashy about poverty. It's just that even that term, I tell you something, it's made by the plutocracy, so that the only reason you'll have some poor white folks is because they're trash. Okay, and by allowing other white people to look down at those other white people, it gives those whites that are marginal some stance to say, "Oh, I'm okay," and they're not really white people. They're
that's
really
right.
White
that's
trash.
Right.
So that I wanted to kind of correct that.
Well, the poor are an underclass.
Exactly.
And the fact that they've been able to distract us by attaching a racial connotation to the poor is absurd. And, you know, it needs to be struggled against. And any time the conversations turn to a racial element, I think it's terrible. It pushes
yes
us away from the more important thing, which is a class inequality and an economic class unfairness.
You're absolutely right. We're going to cover that in the next segment. And thank you very much, Bob, for your call. And please keep calling on. We do this every Saturday. 661, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hello?
Yeah, 661, you're hot.
Oh, hi. I'm actually using Skype, so I wasn't sure how my number would look.
Oh, okay. So what's your name, sir?
My name is Paul.
Hey, Paul, how you doing? Talk to me.
Well, I'm kind of just tuning in. excuse me, sorry. And there's a lot of issues been going on, you know, about the whole, you know, the debt, the race, which to me it's really sad that things happen like this way. Like, personally, I don't agree with a lot of things that the president has done, and I found less times that the race card, you know, so to speak, will be used when disapproval of the president is made. And, you know, when it comes to the whole poverty thing, I found that there's a lot of sense of entitlement when it comes to poverty. Like, someone who I'm very close to is trying to get on disability, for instance, and he told me why. And I'm sitting there thinking, you can overcome all this. Just show some drive.
Right.
There's such a sense of entitlement among poor people, and it doesn't matter if you're black, white, Asian, Hispanic. You know, if you have enough drive, anybody can make it in the system. I think the only problem with the system, really, is the politicians. Politicians are power hungry, money hungry. And, you know, I have no problem with people wanting money.
Paul, can I interrupt you for 1 second? I really want to hit you on one subject because, first of all, I have seen many of people who you are absolutely correct. They attempt to get on disability, but really they don't need it. I tell you something. I have a wife with lupus that really cannot hold down a full-time job or anything like that. And I remember a whole lot of friends saying, hey, why don't you just get her to go on disability or that sort of stuff? And my answer to them is, look, I am a big mouth. I talk a lot. I do radio shows. I do all of this. Can you imagine somebody in the right wing see my wife on a good day when she's playing tennis, put in her video and saying, hey, if she can play tennis, why can't she be out there working? But I know the reality of the disease she has. Some days are good, some days are bad, and you never know. So I guess what I'm trying to say is you are correct that there are a lot of people that may be that may go on disability that really don't belong there. But I think a lot of times when we focus that sort of stuff on the poor, we forget the sense of entitlement that our 1% really has, our plutocracy really has. I mean, that they are getting free money for the – and Jeff can attest to this when he comes back on – that they are getting free money to loan us at an interest rate is a dead giveaway from our government to them. That they have certain perks. I mean, there are huge giveaways more so on the side of the plutocracy than on the side of the lazy poor. And when I say lazy poor, that's the only – I mean that subsection of the poor that is lazy. By no means am I trying to denigrate the poor, because there are people that because of consequences, because of your education level, they just will never, especially in a country that doesn't really have a living wage, they just won't ever get out of that cycle. So,
you know, that just makes me touch on another subject in a sense. I used to be friends with somebody that made some tough decisions in her life and finds herself really struggling. And she is always talking about how we need a level playing ground, how we need more this, more that. And, you know, I'm like, you know what? I have made some questionable decisions in my life that I am daily living with the consequences of. But I'm not blaming anybody except for myself. To me, it just makes me fight harder to succeed, to provide for my family. You know, it's like quit making excuses.
Paul, look, you're correct. What you have to do as a citizen of the United States is to lead by example, promote that, and like I always say on every one of our shows, use your sphere of influence to help folk. But the one thing we cannot do is do what America is doing. I mean, what our plutocracy is doing right now. And we are hammering down on the poor. We are finding all the bad that the poor is doing. And we're using that to not look at where most of the ills are really occurring. We look at a war that costed $2 trillion, nowhere close to what the let's say the poor takers are taking. But, you know, so, I mean, we could go on and on. But, Paul, I'm going to bring you back. What I want to do real quickly is I have a 3-minute blog that I need to read here that's going to talk about President Obama and the budget. And then I really want to open up the calls for that one, unless you have something quick you want to say.
Just that I think that people should be more open to helping each other, not due to the government, but by taking the personal responsibility to help out our fellow people, not enabling them, but helping them.
Jeff is going to love you for saying that. Jeff, I'm going to be coming back to you after I read my blog first, okay? And then we'll then start going down the list again. Thank you very much, Paul. Okay, this other blog that I actually wrote was called Obama Falling Into Trap Again. It's not the debt, new Occupy movement needed. And by that, you'll see what I mean. And I'm going to try to read it pretty fast. Middle class and poor America must be climbing the walls. President Obama ran a middle class centric campaign and won handedly. He not only won the election, but he added to the Senate and the House. Mitt Romney and Paul Rand's policies were soundly rejected. President Obama's second inaugural speech gave the impression that he would be presenting his version of FDR's second Bill of Rights. What has since happened is that the president has fallen into the Republican trap. Once again, the president has joined the Republican narrative that the biggest crisis facing America is our debt and budget deficits. The fact is that neither the national debt nor the deficit are insurmountable problems or problems that need to be tackled now. The results of attempting austerity and debt reductions during recessions are clear. United Kingdom and the various other European countries that attempted this have depressed their economies further. When one focuses on numbers and not emotions, clarity comes quickly. Paul Krugman's New York Times article, Dwindling Deficit Disorder, needs to be read by our president. He should also pass it on to every congressman and senator. Krugman, after stating the fact that, and this is Krugman, for 3 years and more, policy debate in Washington has been dominated by warnings about the dangers of budget deficits. A few lonely economists have tried from the beginning to point out that this fixation is all wrong, that deficit spending is actually appropriate in a depressed economy. But even though the deficit scolds have been wrong about everything so far, where are the soaring interest rates we were promised? Protests that we are having the wrong conversation have consistently fallen on deaf ears. Back to my words. The fact that Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman, along with economists like Joseph Stiglitz, numbers and predictions over the years have been spot on, while those sanctioned by Wall Street, example Peter Moresi, have been steadily wrong, speaks poorly of the media's reporting and politicians' honesty, or at best, their knowledge. Krugman continues providing the realities of public debt management. And these are Krugman's words. People still talk as if the deficit were exploding, as if the United States were on an unsustainable path. In fact, the deficit is falling more rapidly than it has for generations. It is already down to sustainable levels, and it is too small given the state of the economy. Bear in mind that budget doesn't have to be balanced to put us on a fiscally sustainable path. All we need is a deficit small enough that debt grows more slowly than the economy. To take the classic example, America never did pay off the debt from World War II. In fact, our debt doubled in the 30 years that followed the war. But debt as a percentage of GDP fell by 3/4 over the same period. We'll want to reduce the deficits once the economy recovers, and there are gratifying signs that a solid recovery is finally underway. But unemployment, especially long-term unemployment, is still unacceptably high. The boom, not the slump, is a time for austerity. John Maynard Keynes declared many years ago, he was right. All you have to do is look at Europe to see the disastrous effects of austerity on weak economies, and this is still nothing like a boom. My words now. Krugman acknowledges the structural problems that must be addressed with an aging population in the long term, not still that of a robust recovery. There are, of course, long-term fiscal issues. Rising health costs and an aging population will put budget under growing pressures over the course of the 2020s. But I have yet to see any coherent explanation of why these longer-run concerns should determine budget policy right now. And as I said, given the needs of the economy, the deficit is currently too small. Krugman acknowledges that many are using the fear of the debt and deficit as an excuse to dismantle the social safety net. And he says, now I'm aware that the facts about our dwindling deficits are unwelcome in many quarters. Fiscal fearmongering is a major industry inside the Beltway, especially among those looking for excuses to do what they really want, namely dismantle Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. People whose careers are heavily invested in the deficit scold industry don't want to let evidence undermine their scare tactics. As the deficit dwindles, we're sure to encounter a blizzard of bogus numbers purporting to show that we're still in some sort of fiscal crisis. He finishes with the reality that must be broadcast loudly and often throughout the country. And it goes like this. The deficit is indeed dwindling, and the case for making the deficit a central policy concern, which was never, ever strong given low borrowing costs and high unemployment, has now completely vanished. And this is my continuation. Many get upset when the president is accused of not leading. Most people who have made that accusation were rarely friends of the middle class, the poor, or of this president. The president has now been reelected by a substantial margin. The policies he ran on are what most Americans want. These are not policies that can be considered the tyranny of the majority that need protection from Senate filibusters and obstructionist Republicans in the House, e.g., the majority pilfering the wealthy or the minority, the majority taken away from the minority. It's none of that. After all, the converse is true. With that said, one must admit that if the debate is on the debt and deficits and not what ails the economy, the middle class, the poor, the students, the veterans, etc., then it is fact that the president is not using his bully pulpit to lead and to educate. It is true that the right-wing echo chamber has polluted the body politic with misinformation, as Krugman so aptly states. It is the president's duty to know to begin the real fight against the damage inflicted on the American by the right. He is not leading on this issue. He has no more elections to be concerned about. It is time for him to pull his party, kicking and screaming if necessary, to do the right thing. And what are the right thing? No cuts to Social Security. Raise the cap to ensure that the wealthy pays in more. Reform Medicare to prevent drug companies, hospitals, and specialists from pilfering the country's coffers. And it was shown in that Times article how bad that was. Tax capital gains at the same rate. In my opinion, it should really be more, but at least at the same rate as the working people's income. Remove all corporate tax breaks for any company that's offshoring or outsourcing American jobs. This is not a tax the rich scheme. They are policies that acknowledge the structural income and wealth disparity built into our form of capitalism that can only be mitigated through policies that act as a damper to a structural defect. Is a teacher or professor worth orders of magnitude less than the broker or banker she taught? Absolutely not. And by the way, I covered that in my book, As I See It, Class Warfare, the Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom. In 2011, when the discussion focused solely on the debt and deficits, it took the emergence of Occupy Wall Street to change the narrative. Income inequality and wealth disparity entered the lexicon. After an election where middle-class income and wealth was likely uttered more than in the last 30 years, it is incumbent that the president, his party, the middle class, and the poor do not allow Republicans to change the narrative for their ultimate goal of destroying America's social safety net. It may take a new Occupy-style movement to peacefully march on the streets with resolve to demand that their will be effected. And that's the end of the blog. I am almost scared to bring in Jeff. Oh, I don't see Jeff there anymore. So I guess he jumped off of the call. But anyway, let me bring in Joe and see what Joe thinks about that. Go ahead, Joe.
I totally agree with you. Mr. Krugman is somebody I've been following. I totally understand that we have debt. But, and I've heard this on a number of talk shows, Republicans admit exactly that. It's not about eliminating the debt. It's getting it under control. Now, I'm a retired person myself, okay? And I realize there's a lot more of us retiring every day. The long-term problem will be paying our benefits that we have earned. The younger generation, okay, are the ones that need the jobs. And they need the jobs at livable, comfortable wages. A good number of them carrying college debt. What I'm seeing from the plutocrats, if you will, is my words, a scheme, okay? They want higher debt. They want higher employment, okay? And as I'm observing, what they want to do is privatize everything, okay, if it becomes cheap enough. If people aren't earning enough to pay the taxes to support this, if you give them artificial tax breaks and then ask them out of their pockets to pay more and they can't, it makes those libraries and schools and public services easier to take over. Then they will own them. They will have unemployed that will probably be happy to take cheaper jobs, okay? And they'll lower the cost because they'll have low wages and they'll be in charge of everything, okay? So, you know, when you weigh all this out, right, Krugman, Stiglitz, if I'm pronouncing his name right, these economists have the better picture. And it's something most people I know would agree with. Let's get the economy back on track. Let's get good, substantial wages to the people that have jobs and need jobs. With that tax base, just as we did in the 50s and 60s, you'll have a strong middle class. Then from there, you design ways, when they're on their feet, to take care of the other necessities. Then the Social Security Trust, even Medicare, are in problems. They're not insurmountable. They'll only be insurmountable if we don't have enough people contributing to them. And it's my feeling that's what the plutocrats want. They want them to collapse. And to do that, you simply offshore the jobs, keep your money in offshore accounts, and put politicians in office that will make sure nobody passes laws to change it. My thoughts.
Listen, that you hit it on the money. I'm going to kind of go through the cycle and see. Bruce, I'm coming to you next to get your thoughts. Bruce Barnes?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I want to get, did you listen to the blog post? Do you have some thoughts on the policies?
I thought it was perfect. I really enjoyed everything you said, and I'm with Paul Krugman. I'm also with Robert Reich, and everybody ought to read his blogs, too. He has some very good points on there. There's something I would like to say about it, though, and that is about the debt that, well, we don't want debt for two reasons. If there's too much debt, it puts more money into the regular economy, and we have inflation. That's not happening now. The other thing is the debt is low, and when they came out with the debt ceiling, that was says like $16 trillion. Well, the actual GDP is like $15 trillion, so it would assume that you're over 100% of GDP. That's not true. We have only about $10 trillion of public debt. And we compare all the countries and everything to public debt, not total debt. So the debt that is above public debt is not interest. So we are not accruing a lot of interest, which is the other factor of why we want to keep debt down. The interest goes up. But the actual public debt is like 70% of GDP. We're not paying a lot of interest, and it's not going up. So that's not a problem either. So you want to comment on that?
No, you're, listen, it is interesting that you mentioned that about the difference between public and private debt. They don't what they want to do, a lot of times when these guys are putting out the debt, they want to make it look as bad as possible, so they include all these other issues. And you were actually kind of nice, because another thing that they normally include is what's known as the unfunded liabilities, which include pensions and all of that, and that is in several decades, tens of trillions of dollars. So, I mean, they don't say all these things. The reality is, however, that you are correct. That's what they do. They try to maximize exactly what the debt looks like. But let me move on, Bruce, to Neil, see if Neil has something to add, and then I'll come back around, okay?
Thank you.
Actually, we have a new caller that I better go ahead and pull out first. 404, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Robert Rodrigo, guys. How's everybody today?
My brother. How you doing, Rodrigo?
Very good, very good. You know, very familiar with the Krugman stuff and him himself. I have some thoughts. Bear with me for a second. I have some thoughts about this whole process. I think that the discussion that you were just having, which I pretty much agree with from a standpoint of principle all the way around, and policy, I almost think that it's a premature discussion, and I'll tell you why. If you and I and some of the other callers that are on this show right now, for example, if we were part of our elected official group in Congress, we would be doing the kicking and screaming as described in the blog that you just read.
Right.
What troubles me about what goes on in Congress, and you're going to be very familiar with this, most everybody is, what troubles me about what's going on here, and what troubles me about the president, is I'm still of a mind that I can't name 10 people in Washington that I can say 100% truly are working for us as a people. I'm not interested in lobbying, not interested in fundraising, not interested in only being reelected as soon as they get in there, regardless of whether they're a congressman or a senator. And when we talk about money in politics, which, you know, I usually wind up there anyway, no matter what we're talking about, is the Democrats are just as guilty as it is from the Republican standpoint. It's almost like the argument that we're having, and if it wasn't for the Tea Party and some of the extreme polarization rhetoric that we've heard in the last 3 years, I think we would see it a lot clearer. You know, the Democrats should be kicking and screaming about this. We should be able to create a list of 10, easy. These 10 people we know are out there beating the crap out of these ridiculous positions. And I'll give you a good example. If you take the lesser of two evil approach, let's say, one of the conservative arguments is that you can't raise minimum wage because we'll feel it at the cash register. Let's just make it that simple. One of my counters is that even if you raise minimum wage just to the $9 an hour, you're still only making $18,000 a year, and you're still below the poverty line, which is ridiculous. You know, in theory, from the standpoint of our economic level that we are at, minimum wage should be going to $15 at least an hour, which is not going to happen.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second. Robert, I want to interrupt you for 1 second because inherently what they're saying, once somebody says that we cannot afford to have minimum wages that pay a living wage, it means that your economic system is really unsustainable. So I just wanted to add that. Go ahead and continue.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There's so many attachments to these statements anyway. Absolutely. But then, so as part of the counter, what you have is the same group of people are saying they want smaller government. Well, okay, let's say I agree with that aspect from the standpoint of safety nets. Whatever the issue is, Social Security, Medicare, and really Social Security shouldn't be in the discussion at all because we've paid into that and Medicare. But let's say I agree with that. Okay, well, you don't get both. If you are not going to give people a living wage, you have to leave the safety net because that at least gives them the opportunity just to have a living wage. So you raise the income and you lessen government. So I am certainly not a Nobel Prize winning economist, but I defy anybody at any level to dispute that argument on its basic common sense principle. So here we have all these people in Washington, certainly more educated than I am on these issues, certainly inside of them every day, certainly negotiating every day, and I don't hear the clear responses to these individual items. It's all about polarization, which makes me know everybody's got their hand out. You know, I mean, I may be able to say Bernie Sanders works for us, for example, and of course, the right will go, but yeah, but he likes socialism, he's even said it. Okay, whatever. But that's not my saying. And then, like Bill Maher mentioned the other night, there has been no press about what the Progressive Caucus has put out there as a possible budget item.
Let me stop you right there. I have been promoting it's called the People's Budget, and I've been promoting the People's Budget for the last 6 months, if not longer. And I tell you what, the reason it doesn't get any access is that it actually makes sense. If you take,
yes.
I mean, it's easy to read, and you understand the only different the problem with the people's budget is that it says one important thing: you get no free ride. In other words,
right.
You don't get a chance to hide your money. You don't get a chance to do all these things. You know, the thing that we have, I wrote an article a few last year for the paper here called What You're Worth, in which I stated that, believe it or not, the reason that things are the way they are, it really has little to do with a lot of policies. It has to do with policies, but a lot of the policies are able to be made because enough Americans don't have that thing called self-worth. In other words, and I always like to use the teachers as the example because teachers are like the people that I adore. Okay, I adore whether you're an elementary school teacher or a professor.
Everybody has access to it.
Right. I have a special love for them because if you honestly look at society, the people that actually move society forward, what moves society forward other than people having progressive knowledge going on? These are the people that move knowledge along. They have to know a whole lot. Yet, they are the people that are always fighting to get something. They are always treated as if they are on the begging. Oh, we the taxpayers, the people that spend all this time with our kids, they have to beg us for a raise. They are somehow worth less than a stockbroker, somebody that moves some numbers on a sheet. They're worth more than a banker that does produce nothing. They're worth more than let's say, I remember I wrote another blog on Mitt Romney that stated the following. Mitt Romney likes to talk about makers and takers, right? Please tell me what has Mitt Romney made? You want to know somebody can be in what somebody is worth. Throw them on a desert island and see how they can take care of themselves. I can guarantee you that a lot of our plutocracy, you put them there without the servants who know how to do things, will not be able to survive. Who is worth more again? We need to once we start as Americans having self-worth, we will then feel that resolve to go and fight and not ask, but take what is ours. Continue, Robert.
Well, agreed. And you know, the interesting part, you know, talking about the people's budget, well, I have not vetted this, so take that I don't like to talk about too many things unless I've researched it, but Martin made a comment that was very interesting about that particular budget. He said that they removed the title, and again, we're talking about polarization again, but they removed the title of what the budget was called, and they put it out there on the basis of what's in it. It's the same thing they did with the Affordable Health Care Act one time. And they put it out there, and you know, the poll said, and again, I emphasize, I have not vetted this yet, but let's assume for the sake of, because it makes common sense, when they put it out there, that 47%, for example, of Republicans, supported it on the basis of not knowing it was part of the Progressive Act, because we know how that works. And
right.
I know that it happened with the Affordable Health Care Act. So, again, there's so many arguments that have happened during the election cycle. The Affordable Health Care Act is a great example. When you have, I mean, I just got a bunch of information about the Affordable Health Care Act from people who I respect that I know is 100% wrong in the sense of facts. And a prediction that is based upon just conjecture has nothing to do with what's in reality. But these are people that even work inside the industry. So it is totally ridiculous. And one of my comments was, why, if that's the case, if this is really happening, why didn't the people who opposed it as an electric point actually bring up these items? If you tell people in the world that you're going to pay, and here's why, and you're going to pay double what you pay now across the board for your premiums, and I can show it to you 100% in the language of the statute, the president gets hammered in the election. Never happens. So I automatically am skeptical. So I get the sense that there, as I've always had, since Reagan, actually, that there is not really when it comes to fighting for us, there's really not a two sides of the aisle when it comes to what is actually happening inside the walls of Congress with the lobbyists involved, with the needing to want to have elected officials, and all the money that corrupts. And so I get frustrated when I see, for example, we talk about the president, there's no new elections and stuff like that. Absolutely, he should be out there pounding on the pulpit going, look. And he should have all of the people in the party or on both sides, because to me it's ridiculous that there aren't people on both sides of the aisle whatever aisle that is, that would not support facts regardless. Because it's got to be. I mean, there's 535 of them. And to me, that is the most ridiculous part of what our process presents to me. So I think that we're battling money only. I don't think we're even battling anything but that, because I don't believe that there's 535 people in there that stupid, and I don't believe I'm smarter than everybody. So,
here's the deal, Robert. Here's the deal. I don't know if you saw what I stamped on the blog post for this show today. Earlier this week, one of our board members created a logo for what we're doing. It's called it's pasted on the blog post for this show.
Where yeah, it says, I saw it.
The campaign, yeah. And let me tell our audience, it's called the Campaign to Reverse Citizens United. It's deeper than just Citizens United, but that is a call phrase that everybody knows. So it is one of the reasons we are starting this campaign is for exactly what you've just said there. In other words, yeah. You said your statement when you started the call, started talking, you said, and 6-2-0, I'm coming to you next. You said, I don't know if I can find 10 people who support policies that support me. I don't know if I can find 10 people who want to go ahead and do these things. Well, guess what? We don't have an intention of finding 10 people. We have an intention of putting 535 of them on the spot.
Let me just jump in there 1 second and clarify something for you, because I understand what you just said, but actually my point is not so much that I can't find 10 people that support what I want. I can't find 10 people that support what anybody wants,
right?
And don't have the other agendas attached to them.
Right.
I don't necessarily, you know. Again, you know how we are. What our approach is in the coffee party. It's not about everybody agreeing. It's about having elected officials that truly work for the citizenship. Not
exactly.
You know, so I don't. They don't have to all agree with me, but I want to have a true argument. And one other point, because I know you want to move on to a couple other calls, please. But one other point I'll make is lately as I've been reading the posts, I'm actually behind in mine for what my responsibilities are, but when I've been reading some of the posts, I will say to the majority of the people who are posting, one of the things I don't want to get caught in is that we are becoming only progressive for the same reasons that I'm talking about all this polarization. There are plenty, Michael Sun is a great example. There are plenty of common sense, real approaches and true arguments or debates that can be made with all kinds of ideals on both of the so-called progressive, conservative, when you remove all the rhetoric. And I want everybody to at least respect opinions enough to read. I'm definitely more progressive, but that's irrelevant. I need to know facts. And please, I just say please to everybody, remember that we are about facts less than position. It's all about facts and then learning from them and getting our elected officials to please use them and don't lie to us and get the media out of the way.
Now, the good commentary, and that folks, for those conservatives that are listening, is that encouragement for you to get engaged. Yes, some of us are more on the liberal side, but we also have quite a few conservatives here, including those on the board of directors. So you should actually say your piece. Now, there's one thing that I want to add to that, Robert, and that is the fact that we have to realize that what we are calling, let's look at a lot of the policies that the president has passed thus far. You can't really consider those policies to have been left policies, but actually middle ground policies. I had to turn your mic off for the noise, but 620, I am coming to you right now. 620, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Yeah, this is Jack Golden again.
Senor Golden, talk to me.
Okay, I was very disturbed by the very first thing that came on my email. There's Newsmax. They say, alarm that this nation is going to the dogs. I mean, this will go the way of Britain did in 40 years ago. And what I say is that they went on and on and on and on and on. I could, about 14 minutes, wasting my time. This so-called economist, I don't know who the hell he was, through Newsmax. Oh, okay, the centerpiece was, center part was, the Big Bang banks that finance homes.
Right.
Medicaid and, what the hell, the Mary Kay and
I get your point.
Yeah. Okay. They busted, and so does our attempt at down to interest down to less than barely above zero.
Right.
So I mean, I don't believe in doomsday prophecies.
Right.
There's this nation going to go. I think it's. I am pessimistic about dealing with the Republicans with Paul Ryan. And all that stuff is a waste of time. With Obama trying to deal with Paul Ryan and Boehner and those guys, because they want to shrink the size of government to down to a bathtub.
And, you're right, but I tell you what, I am not pessimistic at all. Okay, I don't, pessimism doesn't run in my blood. I simply believe those of us who know need to get our butts up, like we're doing right now and listening to the show, like Coffee Party is doing with the 535 campaign that we're going to be running. There is a whole lot to be done. You know, I mean, that is what most people.
Okay, the 535 campaign, I'm with him. Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
My representative is Hillscamp. He is in Kansas, and he is a big mocker in the Tea Party.
Yeah, that's fine. We don't care what they are, because when we ask you to join 535, we're going to ask you to go out there or get somebody to go out there for us, Jack. So we're going to be depending on you, okay?
Yeah.
So we'll be in touch, Jack. I got two more calls I got to run to, but rest assured, we'll be in touch, okay?
Yeah, that's how we're going to do it. That's I want to join somebody else in Kansas that's willing to work with me. And I think I have to go to Topeka or Wichita for that.
That's
in,
okay.
At
we'll
the opposite end of the state.
That's right. We'll work on that. We know that some of the bigger states have little population and they're long distances, but that's what we're going to kind of work out. We're still doing a whole lot of the plans, but rest assured, it's coming. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jack. Okay, 908. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, buddy. How are you doing? This is John Jersey.
Hey, John. Talk to me, John.
Well, I find it interesting what this thing where Ron Paul's son did recently with the drones thing to sort of gain, I guess, sort of a liberalistic approach. You know, to gain what I think, I guess they're looking for liberal votes, you know, but he's an ultra conservative looking for, you know, some maybe liberals additionally. And, you know, the CPAC or whatever decided to really go with him. I mean, they look like CPAC or this and that are going for, you know, the father of a libertarian. He's Tea Party conservative, but has a libertarian views.
Yeah, he's almost a straight libertarian.
Yeah, well, he's still attached to the Tea Party, regardless. I mean, he's with the Tea Party, regardless. He's still a conservative libertarian, whatever you want to call him, which I find, you know, interesting, because they snubbed Rubio at the this thing too. You know, they're snubbing a bunch of other people for their presidential, and CPAC is pretty much full fledged forward with Paul. I find it very interesting, you know, and but you know, I think that they're playing to where they're going to play that, you know, for the next election, and I guess I think they built it up, or they were looking to build it up from 2012 to 2016 that way. But additionally, with our New Jersey governor, you know, they're looking to you know, a sort of a guy who's good at business, who's strong-headed, and this and that, and they're looking to see, you know, who is going to come to the forefront of the party in 2016 and basically, you know, make him look like somebody who can work together. Like, you know, as they're doing, they're blaming Obama, he can't work together, this and that, you know, so here, well, you know, 2016, you know, we got a candidate like you know, New Jersey's governor who can work together with people, and he's got 70% approval rating, even though he's not doing very well, really, in the state. I mean, the state used to be third in employment, and now it's towards the bottom, and it's towards the bottom in a lot of other categories, which it was never at the bottom. You know, and it's very interesting, you know, that they're still, you know, what they're going to do for 2016 with, I think, these two people towards the top now.
Yeah, well, who knows what they're going to do? The truth of the matter is, I don't think there's much. How should I put this? I want to put this the right way. I think if groups like ours, Coffee Party, Move to Mend, and some other organizations out there get the job done, Americans are going to vote their pocketbook. And if Americans vote their pocketbook, they're only people who support middle-class-centric policies are going to win. And the only way that means Republicans get ahead is if they change their policies. And I tell you what, if they change their policies, that'll be fine.
But let me ask you something.
They should send a shot. Yeah.
Let me ask you something. When you say in regards to the Coffee Party, you know, you guys are mostly desiring to have a dual narrative both ways. But you guys are not looking to put, those to where we would have candidates or supporting of other candidates of, that are not on polarized sides of the aisle. I'm sort of confused in regards to.
No, there's really no confusion. We're not a party, okay?
That's correct. Yeah.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, all we support is policies to put it bluntly, middle class centric policies. Okay. Anybody
right,
that
you
supports
support policies, but how are you going to make a direct effective of change unless there's people, you know, within?
We are actually, like I said, right now we push policy. There are some aspects of our board right now that's actually discussing how later on are we going to talk about supporting particular people or not necessarily supporting particular people, but letting people know people that are actually middle class centric friendly. I don't know, there are legalities that you have to go through hoops for depending on what you're going to do, and I don't quite have them all down myself.
Well, Alberto, there was one thing recently that where they were doing site on and where they were looking for these candidates that were non-polarized candidates, and they were for presidential or for other elections and stuff like that. And I'm trying to remember the name of the site, but I know
that's
that
no labels.
No, there was another one too. I guess that maybe that one, but there was another one too. And are you guys looking to support these, you know, maybe third or fourth, you know, these additional parties? People who are independents.
Honestly, John, I can't answer that question right now. There are certain things that are in flux that I am not qualified or authorized to talk about. So
right,
I can't quite say that. But look, hang with me. I have another call that I need to take as well. But all that you're saying, right, the things that concern you, that you want to know, you need to drop us a line. And, we keep all of that when we're going over our plans and wanting to know where our members actually are. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, John. Now, I think this may be a Skype call. 661 is what it's appearing on my channel. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes, is this Skype?
Yeah, it's funny. My call got I got disconnected, and I found it funny. Skype seems to change the number every time, I guess.
I don't know what it does, but it has your number as area code 661.
Oh, all right. My name is Paul. I was talking to you before
yeah,
about
I remember
the whole racism
voice.
Stuff.
Yeah,
well,
we're back
to
budget now.
Yeah, I listened to the blog, and I have a funny way going about things. I look at what the government politicians say, and I take a look at what the various parties say.
Uh-huh.
Personally, my views certainly do line up with various parties. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a party. I'm a patriotic
right.
American. And whenever I see something that looks like maybe propaganda or something, you know, I take a look at the facts myself. And a lot of times when I see these people that claim to be economists, like high powered or whatever, a lot of times I find what they're saying does not really line up. And there have been times when I've had the opportunity to talk to people that supposedly have these high power positions and people that are informed. And what I find is that when I present them with what I find to be common sense, they take one of three approaches. They either will change the topic of the conversation, they will end the conversation, or they will make extremes to make their point. And I'm not sure what approach the guy would take, but I don't agree much at all with what that economist said, according to what you read.
Yeah, let me say, I hope I didn't read it wrong or misunderstand it, because here's the deal with Krugman and also Stiglitz and also Richard, I don't remember the name of the economist, Richard something. These guys, the way I judge an economist is how much of what he says, because remember, economics is not a complete science, right? Because it depends on how people behave. I mean, if we write an economic policy, we write it assuming people are going to behave a certain way. If they don't behave a certain way, then the economic policy is not worth the paper it's written on. Now, what Krugman says is he comes out and he says, based on the past, based on how people act or likely to act, this is what would occur. What Krugman is saying is, yes, we have a budget deficit, and let's start looking at the past. Let's look at what happened after World War II. Did we ever...
I agree with that.
And, you know, so everything that he says was going to come to pass pre both the e-bubble and pre the mortgage bubble and all of these things came to pass. He has a history that you can look at. Now, when he speaks about the budget being controlled, he's not ever talking about, oh, we don't have any debt, or trying to make believe that debt isn't high. Debt is extremely high. What he's trying to say is, as we don't need to take the draconian pains that are not going to really solve the problem. What he was trying to illustrate is, let's say we went into an austerity measure, what we actually would be doing is probably making a deficit worse, because austerity means you're going to lay off a whole lot of people in government and actually slow the economy down. You do this slowdown of the economy, then more people are going to be dependent on government programs like welfare or otherwise. And what that does is further blow up the budget. So he's not speaking abstractly. He's speaking based on what would occur if people behave a certain way. And,
well,
you know, he's been spot on.
I want to ask you something, though.
Yes.
You seem to agree with what he says. And there are a lot of points that I want to address, but we probably don't have enough time to do that. What would you say is a higher dollar amount right now? How much the government takes in, or how much the government spends?
The government spends a lot more than it takes in right now, and the reason why, and there are two reasons why. There are structural reasons why, and there are systemic reasons why. Okay, now let me tell you specifically. Personally, you have to believe numbers, and the truth is our tax rates are the lowest that it has been in generations. Okay, in other words, what the wealthiest paying, et cetera, it's way below. There are some other numbers that you should be aware of. When we found ourselves with this type of income disparity and wealth disparity, last time it was in 1929, and what we've shown based on experience as well is that this type of disparity does not lend itself to an economy that is very vibrant. Why not? It doesn't lend itself to, and that almost comes as a no-brainer. If you don't have the masses capable of spending, then how can an economy move when the robustness of an economy is directly proportional to the amount of times that dollar is spent?
Well, I want to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I something I'm just thinking about here is that, you know, taxes may not be, in some manner speaking, higher, but there certainly may be more of them. And people are complaining about about minimum wage. And like it or not, and I've seen a lot of people that don't like this, minimum wage and government spending are heavily linked, because the more government spending you have, you know, the bigger the deficit gets, the more money is getting printed, the less the dollar is going to be worth. Then things cost more.
companies have to buy more, and if the minimum wage increases, they're going to have to probably let people go because they simply can't afford it. Like, you know, I used to work at McDonald's. I got paid minimum wage. You know,
right. Let's be honest now. I need to refute something here, because what happens is you have you have what people say, and then you have what actually occurs. At no time, and there are studies that have been made, and you can look the studies up. I actually blogged one of the studies on my blog as well, where it shows that increase in the minimum wage has never costed the economy jobs. That's number one. Number two, increase in the minimum wage is actually stimulative. And why is increasing the minimum? What we have to do is not just say yes or no, it's not or not. Is to go ahead and look at the comprehensive research that has actually been done on this. And the one that I posted was not one research. I'll look it up for you, but it's not one research that was done. It was a comprehensive set of researches that actually shows that the increase of the minimum wage does not cost the economy the jobs that you hear people talk about. And not only that, but it is, in fact, stimulative. And if you doubt that it's stimulative, it goes this way. Have you ever wondered why, remember earlier I spoke to you about income disparity creating an unsustainable economy? That is the case, yeah. Because if you have a group of folks hoarding money, that is money that isn't reinvested back into the economy per se. It's money that's not going into the people that spend it. And what makes an economy is the motion of money, the movement of money. And if money is not being moved, you do not have a vibrant economy. When they I'll be honest with you. I think after X amount of dollars, and I don't know what that amount of dollars is, I think tax rates are supposed to be very high. Because hoarding of income, hoarding of wealth, it's just a form of it's just an aberration within an economic system.
Hoarding or saving?
There's a difference between saving and hoarding, right?
I know that, but I'm wondering, the liberals don't seem... I've seen a lot of liberals being against capitalism, and this whole conversation reminds me of a conversation I had with a professor of geology. I asked him some simple questions, and he says, well, I would have to, you know, have a board here, make a ton of calculations. And I said, no, forget the calculations. Just answer some simple questions. I said, you know, you're making a very simple problem incredibly complex so that you're trying to make it so the average person cannot understand it. But while it really is, it's all of, the only thing that's making this into rocket science are the people in government trying to make this seem so complicated. You know, it's really not rocket science. You know, take a look at the Constitution. Everything is outlined there. You know, it's really not that difficult.
Yeah, but wait a minute. The Constitution are words, and that can be quite simple, right? Calculating how money runs through an economy based on all the things within the economy, as a great example, the people that I consider the ones that do the least work, the titans of finance, the bankers, etc. Right? They have created financial instruments that influence our economy. I mean, it produces nothing. These financial instruments are simply created so that somebody can make a profit off of money. As an example, a derivative that insures another piece of a piece of stock or whatever. These are financial instruments solely designed to make a few people money, but they do affect our economies, because when they go wrong, we bail them out, because it doesn't matter how many PhDs they have calculating what the ripple effect of what they're doing is in the economy. As you stated earlier, if we worked on a simple model, in other words, I have a product to sell, we're going to trade something for that product. What do we trade? We either trade another product, or we trade dollars, or we trade ink, or we trade something of equal value for that exchange. We don't do that anymore. We have all these people that have created structures that were not intended to make things easier, but intended to make a few more people more money without doing any work. I mean, it sounds silly for me to say that, but that is bottom line what actually occurs. We have made a group of people that are the real takers. The takers are not those poor people that everyone would like to call the takers. The taker isn't that friend. I think earlier you made a call to us and you mentioned that you had a friend or a relative who was trying to get disability, a few puny pennies he was going to get. Yeah, he may be a minor taker, but the big takers are all those people that sap our economy and using a type of capitalism that it's a type of capitalism that I call an aberration. I believe in capitalism. I believe in free enterprise.
Can I have an example?
Sure. I gave you one very quickly, a derivative. Those guys who tanked the economy created a whole lot of CDOs, credit default obligations. These were based on nothing. In other words, these were certificates that they created to insure debt. And the reason they did it that way is they didn't want it to have any financial backing behind, as an insurance policy would necessarily have to have by law. So they went around the law to create all these instruments. And when one particular big investment bank fell that purchased all this insurance and they had to pay up, there was no money to pay up. So it froze the whole economic system. And guess who paid out guess who brought the economy back? That government that nobody likes, or that government that always gets into our business, that government started to print money, and that government started to make liquid what these guys, the titans of finance, destroyed. And after they did that, after they destroyed that, what happened then? They still were able to profit. And why were they able to profit? Because of that cash flow that was provided by us, the American taxpayer. These things don't really come out there in this fashion. We have a lot of people generally on the right that are always there defending these great capitalists like Romney and these other guys that have produced nothing for society. We constantly look at the poor person that is really trying to make it, and even sometimes trying to make it not the best way. That friend of yours who's trying to get, you know, Social Security or whatever he's trying to get. Oh, he's no different than that plutocrat who's ripping us off. But go ahead again, Paul. Ryan.
You know, you bring up a bunch of points. You bring up some of my own pet peeves. Personally, if I could have, if I could actually, some people say I should run for office. No, because I wouldn't want my life to be that transparent. because of the fact that, I'd be a hypocrite, because I get on the president's case for a severe lack of transparency. I would revamp the whole government. I would get rid of most of it. I would cut its ties to business. I would make businesses properties, property of the owners instead of on separate entities. That's what the Constitution wants. You have the Citizens United thing, and I'm actually for that. And there's not many things that liberals do that I'm actually for. And I like that. That shouldn't even be a question. It's we the people, not we the corporations. I would cut those ties. I would get rid of outsourcing. I'd be very careful about the owners of companies concerned. Let them do what they want. Let the citizens decide, not the government. If a company is going to fall, it's going to fall. I think the government has done far too much to sustain, to sustain the economy. And you have the president taking credit for economic recovery, and it costed us a lot of money. I think the government should stand back and at least, drop taxes. Somebody mentioned earlier, there are lots of things I want to touch on. Somebody mentioned earlier about the taxes and stuff, and the bigger government you have, the more taxes you need. We could afford to have high minimum wages if the taxes were different. If we were taxed
I really have to stop you there and ask you a few questions. Okay. And the reason why is this: you're throwing out a whole lot of talking points. Here's the deal: you want to lower taxes. Okay, that's fine. That's an argument we can have. But my question to you is, first of all, we are currently running a deficit, okay, a large deficit.
Oh, yeah.
You want to further lower taxes, which would, by definition, create a larger deficit.
No.
What are you willing
– what I said.
I know. Let me finish, because I know the argument. My next question to you, sir, is what do you cut?
What do you cut? Cut everything that is not constitutional. I've taken a look at, and I've kind of laid out a plan of this. I take a look at it. It is some, because of the fact of how dependent the American people have become on the government, this would have to be a very careful process. But if you could manage to cut out everything that is not constitutional slowly over probably a decade or so, and bring various departments and authorities back to the state, and you could, it would work, and I would support the probability or the plausibility of keeping taxes the way they are for at least a time until the deficit is under control. But if you do that, then it will be practically a utopia. I mean, now of course it won't be an ideal situation, but it'll be much better than what we have now.
Okay, let me just say something that I hope you realize. My biggest problem when folks talk about the government doing X and the government doing Y, right, is I almost call it an abdication of our duty, because I think whenever you feel free to speak about the government as it is something separate from you, I think that's a problem. In other words, when I think about government, I think about we the people. I think about the government, and I'm saying right now government isn't we the people, because government is controlled by a few people, the corporation, etc. But that is one of my goals, or one of our goals, is to make the government we the people again. Because the disdain, there is a certain disdain that many Americans start to have when they talk about the government, or the government this or the government that. It's almost an unpatriotic thing to speak that way about the government, which is we the people. We have to not try to say we don't want the government doing X, Y, Z. We have to start thinking about the government as being something that we are the ones who decide what the government is going to do.
Well, that's what it was.
Yeah. Now, when you speak about things like the Constitution, et cetera, we want to have – I look at a constitution as a guiding document, but I don't look at the constitution as absolute. There's no man on this planet 200-something years ago that can possibly know all the things that we would be going through in 2013. It is naive for us to think that guys who rode on horses and never knew about electricity or never knew about nuclear power or never knew about damming a river, or never knew about the laws of physics, how we are going to try to make our current world be based entirely on that.
The thing is, we make things far too complicated, just like I told you about that professor I talked to.
No, but I want to interrupt you again, Paul. There are certain, and this is the thing that gets me a lot of times with a lot of folks on the right. Certain things, I'm sorry, I'm an engineer by training. Certain things are just not simple. When we talk about heat transfer and boundary layers, that is not easy. That is a difficult thing. When we talk about flow of air in certain conditions, it is not an easy thing. It is difficult. And there's nothing I can possibly do to simplify that. And for those people who come out and say, oh, let's make things simple. I'm sorry. All things are not simple. The way your body works is not simple. Your body is a complex engine.
Well,
go ahead,
you know, that actually has a very interesting correlation. This is going to become obvious more, but I happen to be a Christian, and
right.
Yes, our body's absolutely, absolutely complex. I am beyond imagination. Our body's more complex than the most sophisticated supercomputer in the world.
Amen. Amen.
But now a lot of liberals argue me on this. Our founding documents, Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, the Mayflower Compact, I can't remember what they're called, all the Federalist letters.
The Federalist Papers, yeah. Federalist.
Okay, there we go. And various documents that have been mailed out from the founding fathers, all of them point to all of them point to God, the Creator. They also made it abundantly clear that government is, yes,
we the people. Unfortunately, things have shifted dramatically in a bad way. They wanted to keep government simple so it does not rule the people. The government is supposed to be a place of honor and privilege. It's not supposed to be queer. It's not even supposed to have anything to do with people's business.
Okay, Paul, I'm going to have to go around to some other people, but let me just tell you, no, the government is not what you described. The government is what the majority of the people that are voting want the government to be. That a sect of people decide that they want a government a certain way is just that, a sect of people that believe that. And if you want the government to be that way, that which you believe, then you build the grassroots movement to attain that. I would tell you one thing. I have a lot of respect for the conservatives that have turned this country around over the last 30-something years, because they have used bad policy but successfully created a grassroots movement that made bad policy vogue. I am saying that my goal right now as a person, as an individual, and hopefully with the different organizations that we're serving with, is to change policy, to create grassroots movements that change policies, but instead of making policies based on hopes and all that sort of thing, make policies based on facts. But look here, Brian, you keep calling me because we'll keep talking, and I love hearing different points of views. I think John wanted to come back into the discussion. John, you're a hot. Come on in.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of back and forth quickly if we could with Brian, but the thing with
we only have 10 minutes, so I'm just
kind
well,
yeah,
of just
no, I understand. I understand.
Yeah.
I just want to make the points where he keeps saying that whatever it discusses capitalism in the Constitution, where? Okay.
Nowhere.
That it doesn't. Nowhere. I mean, that's economics, and yes, Hamilton, he goes into a little bit this thing about capitalism, banking, and all that stuff, but like also Federal Reserve wasn't around until 1913 and that kind of stuff. There was only a Treasury. But I'm saying it doesn't say capitalism in the Constitution at all, and he keeps referring as if it does. But additionally, like, okay, go to the fact with supply versus, companies that can, or demand versus the companies that can, Walmart and that. If they don't have supply, they're non-functional, okay? Their unemployment is killed off, okay? So, I mean, I don't sort of understand his thing about just lowering taxes, and we'll get more businesses and this and that. If there's like, as you are saying with Krugman, for which you are definitely more right, is if there is not to where we restore the middle class having additional monies for spending, we won't get that churning of the economy back. Additionally, I was going to make a point about Ford. Back in the day, well, there's of course an interesting thing with Ford, where others were concerned of why is Ford paying so much more to his employees, and the Carnegie Mellons, back in the day, and you know the story, but the thing is that
our audience a story. That's important.
It's very important. It's so important. He basically decided to pay his employees more wages, and in turn, they were able to buy his cars. And that's exactly what he talked about as far as capitalism economy. But, again, like with Brian, there is no pure capitalism and there is no pure communism. They both don't work. We when we formed the government, there was socialism to begin with, okay? Yes, we talked about a more of a freedom of capitalism and that kind of thing, but right away we had government. That was socialism to begin with.
John, hold on a second. I want to dispel one notion. There is nothing. There's nothing that says capitalism and democracy never belongs in the same sentence. That's something completely different. China is a capitalist country. America is a capitalist country. One is a republic. The other one is a communist state.
Let me put it this way: we are not a pure capitalist state. We are more in the capitalist tendency, but
right.
we do have socialism, of course. If we didn't, we wouldn't have Social Security. There is no pure capitalism and there is no pure communism. We found out that in essence, if you try to take it to both of the extremes, okay, including with us the way we are, okay, and we keep whatever to that extreme, and of course whatever with the Soviet bloc, what they did and their sort of communistic approach, both extremes seem to not work out very well.
You're absolutely correct. And John, I got to stop you there because I need to go to go through the list. I think there are still four people with their hands still up that we'll get to give a closing statement, and then we'll close the show down. Joe Pomponio, I'm coming to you, my friend. Give me a closing statement.
All right, Berto, it was a great show, very informative, and you hit on all the right topics. Okay, I'll be with you again next week for sure.
Great. Thank you, my friend. Bruce Barnes, I'm coming to you next. Bruce Barnes.
I think we ought to continue this next time, and I'll say one thing. All government spending is constitutional. Otherwise, it wouldn't be spending. They would go to the Supreme Court, and they would determine it's not constitutional. So there's a lot of things that needs to be discussed next time.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Brian, I'm coming to you next. Brian, give me a closing statement, sir. Brian, you're on. Okay, let me go to John. John, give me your closing statement.
You know, I just think that Brian needs to reevaluate the way he thinks. I really do.
Thank you very much, John. Everybody has a right to think what they want to think, though. Remember that? We're a free country. But thank you very much, John. Now, folks, please remember that we are starting our new project, the 535 Project. Please go to our website and join the fold. Help us get somebody in every single one of our districts, as we are planning to do. Please remember that we have four coffee party shows on Mondays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. There is Press One for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesday, there is The Middle Ground with Michael Charney and Eric Beiler. That is on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern. On Thursdays, there is at 3 p.m. Eastern, there's Lunch with Loudon. A very nice show. Remember, that's Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard. And, of course, there's Politics Done Right with Egberto. That's me. And that is on Saturdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Please remember, folks, we are a volunteer organization, and we have expenses to cover our internet infrastructure and our databasing and our emailing and all that kind of stuff. So I ask that if you have the wherewithal to go to our website and give us a donation, or why not just become a contributing member? It starts at just $5 a month. It's worth it because we put everything back into our system. Thank you very much for being a part of Politics Done Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. C'est la vie. You guys have a wonderful, wonderful Saturday. Thank you very much, and bye-bye.